Imagine a comedian who could make you laugh until you cried, then, in the very next breath, make you confront uncomfortable, often brutal truths about society and yourself.
Right.
A performer whose raw honesty felt less like a carefully crafted bit and more like an unfiltered, visceral scream right from the soul.
Yeah, that really captures it. Richard Pryor was just that singular, unforgettable force.
Absolutely. A man who dared to bring the deepest parts of his experience, no matter how painful, really, to the brightest stages. Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everyone. Today we are plunging headfirst into the extraordinary, often turbulent, and, well, undeniably influential life of Richard Franklin Lennox Thomas Pryor.
Quite a name.
It is, born December 1st, 1940, in Peoria, Illinois, and passing away December 10th, 2005, in LA. Pryor isn't just a name whispered in the halls of comedic greatness. He's widely seen as one of the most significant, most transformative comedians of all time.
No question.
We're going far beyond the punchlines today, beyond the iconic stand-up specials, to really explore the man behind the genius, a man known for his trenchant observations, unparalleled storytelling, and this almost magical ability to connect with a broad audience in ways few ever have.
Yeah, and our mission today is really to unpack that rich and complex tapestry of Pryor's life and career. We're going to use a detailed look at the available sources to understand not just what he did, but, why it mattered so profoundly.
Exactly. And how?
And how his unique perspective permanently altered the landscape of comedy and culture, really. For you, our listener, this deep dive is your shortcut to being truly well-informed about a figure whose seismic influence is still felt acutely today,
Oh, absolutely.
offering surprising facts and those undeniable aha moments that make understanding history so compelling, all without, hopefully, the information overload.
Definitely. We're going to embark on a journey through his early, incredibly challenging beginnings. I mean, the almost unbelievable environment he grew up in, and then meticulously trace his artistic evolution.
It's quite a path.
It really is. We'll watch as he transforms from a more mainstream, sort of conventional performer into the groundbreaking, fearless, and often confrontational voice he became. We'll delve into his very public struggles with fame, his harrowing health battles, and the profound personal demons that both fueled and plagued him.
A real duality there.
Totally. Ultimately, we'll examine his monumental and enduring legacy, a legacy that continues to resonate decades after his passing. You'll hear about the deeply personal experiences that fueled his genius and the specific career milestones that solidified his irreplaceable place in history.
It's going to be quite the dive.
Let's get into it with
All
the
right.
formative years. Difficult beginning. Okay, so to truly understand Richard Pryor, we have to start right at the beginning. And that beginning was, well, anything but ordinary.
Far from it.
It's a childhood that undeniably laid the raw autobiographical foundation for so much of his later comedy. He was born December 1st, 1940, in Peoria, Illinois, but his home life was worlds away from, the idyllic picture many might imagine. He literally grew up in a brothel vigorously run by his grandmother, Marie Carter.
Think about that. Not just visiting, but living there.
Exactly. This wasn't just a place he occasionally visited. It was his primary residence. And within those walls, his mother, Gertrude L. Thomas, worked as a prostitute and struggled with alcoholism. While his father, Leroy Buck Carter Pryor, a former boxer, hustler, and pimp, added another layer of volatility to this incredibly turbulent picture.
Just layers upon layers of instability.
This wasn't a stable environment for any child, let alone a budding comedic mind. After his mother abandoned him at the tender age of 10,
10 years old.
his grandmother Marie essentially became his primary caregiver. She's often described in accounts as tall, formidable, and physically violent.
Yeah, not exactly nurturing.
No. Apparently, she wasn't shy about beating him, often for what she saw as his eccentricities, maybe early signs of his artistic temperament.
Could be, or just a kid being a kid in an impossible situation.
True. Can you imagine the emotional landscape of growing up in such a place? Seeing the raw underbelly of life every single day? He was one of four children raised within the confines of this brothel.
And the trauma didn't stop at the environment itself, sadly.
No, tragically it didn't. He was sexually abused at just 7 years old.
Unbelievable.
And later, perhaps unsurprisingly, expelled from school when he was only 14.
That's an astonishing amount of hardship packed into such a young life. What's truly fascinating here, though, from an analytical standpoint, is how these traumatic, early experiences, experiences that might be hidden or glossed over in other biographies.
Right.
They became the very wellspring of his material. It raises an important question, I think. For an artist, how much of a comedian's genius is forged in their earliest struggles and their ability to, you know, metabolize that pain?
That's a great point.
For Pryor, it seems the raw pain, the absurdity, and the vivid, often shocking characters of his formative years weren't just background noise. They became the central, unflinching characters in his later comedy.
He wasn't just observing life from a distance. He lived it.
Exactly. In the most visceral sense, stripped of societal pretense. And then, with incredible bravery, he brought every last bit of that lived chaos to the stage, transforming personal agony into communal truth. It's quite something.
His path didn't exactly smooth out after leaving school either.
No kidding.
In fact, he found himself in another structured yet challenging environment, the U.S. Army. He served from 1958 to 1960, but interestingly, he spent virtually his entire stint in an army prison in West Germany.
Yeah, that's a key detail, not just basic training and out.
Right. And this wasn't for some minor infraction that landed him there. A 1999 profile in The New Yorker detailed the harrowing incident. Pryor, along with several other black soldiers, beat and stabbed a white soldier.
Wow.
Apparently, the white soldier had been overly amused by racially charged scenes in the film Imitation of Life.
Oh, okay. So there was a trigger.
Seems so. The soldier fortunately survived, but Pryor was incarcerated for the majority of his service, a stark testament to the consequences of his actions, I suppose.
Well, and this early incident, it really highlights a deep-seated anger, doesn't it? An almost hypersensitivity to racial injustice that would become such a cornerstone of his later, more controversial comedy.
You can see the seeds right there.
Absolutely. It's an early, visceral indicator of his unwillingness to shy away from difficult truths, even at immense personal cost. It shows a young man who, even then, was deeply affected by the racial dynamics around him and was prepared to react, maybe violently, to perceived injustices.
Yeah.
That force would later translate into his fearless stage presence. It's a powerful look into the emotional and psychological landscape that would come to define his artistic output, a willingness to confront, even violently, the ugliness he perceived.
Remarkably, even within these tumultuous early chapters, Pryor was seeking and finding communities. It hints at this deeper need for belonging, maybe.
That makes sense.
We see this, for instance, in his early affiliations. He was a member of Henry Brown Lodge No. 22 in Peoria, where he became a Prince Hall Freemason.
Okay. Prince Hall.
Yeah. For those unfamiliar, Prince Hall Freemasonry is a historically African-American branch of Freemasonry established when black men were excluded from other Masonic lodges.
Right, offering that brotherhood and structure.
Exactly. It offered a sense of brotherhood, community, and moral structure, perhaps a real contrast to the chaos of his upbringing. And maybe a place where his eccentricities were less a target for violence and more a sign of individuality within a supportive, if, you know, secretive network.
A fascinating counterpoint to the rest of his early life.
Yeah.
Early career. The genesis of a legend.
So by 1963, a significant shift happens. Geographically and artistically, Pryor moves to New York City.
Right into the thick of it.
Absolutely. Immersing himself in the burgeoning comedy scene of the time. This was a pivotal moment. He began performing regularly in clubs alongside other future legends, cultural icons like Bob Dylan.
Wow.
Who was making his mark in the folk scene. And Woody Allen, who was also honing his, you know, neurotic intellectual comedic style.
Can you imagine the energy in those rooms?
Seriously. The raw talent, the ambition buzzing in those smoky, intimate clubs during that era, it must have been electric.
Definitely.
However, it was far from an overnight success, and he certainly wasn't the fearless Pryor we'd later know. Not yet.
No, not at all.
Nina Simone, the legendary singer and pianist, shared a particularly telling recollection from one of his first nights. He opened for her at New York's Village Gate.
Right, I remember reading this.
She described his extreme nervousness before performances, saying, and I quote, "He shook like he had malaria. He was so nervous. I couldn't bear to watch him shiver, so I put my arms around him there in the dark and rocked him like a baby until he calmed down."
Wow. Rocked him like a baby.
Night after night, she said, offering him comfort and reassurance.
That anecdote from Nina Simone is incredibly revealing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It shows us the deep vulnerability and, frankly, profound performance anxiety behind the budding artist.
A total contrast to later.
A stark contrast to the fearless, almost confrontational stage presence he would later cultivate. It makes you wonder how many early artists struggle with that intense level of trepidation before they truly find their voice and own their stage.
Yeah.
For Pryor, this initial nervousness makes his eventual metamorphosis into a comedic titan even more profound.
Hmm.
It wasn't an inherent fearlessness, you see. It was a bravery earned through struggle, a battle he fought backstage before ever uttering a word.
Wrestling with his own potential.
Exactly. Haunted by the specter of failure, or perhaps, even more so, the fear of revealing his true self.
Initially, his comedic style was quite different from the raw, explosive persona he eventually became known for.
Oh yeah, very different.
He began as what's often been called a middle-brow comic, largely inspired by the clean, observational humor of Bill Cosby.
The Cosby influence was huge early on.
In this phase, Pryor presented a much less controversial, more palatable version of himself. Imagine a performer charming audiences with universal, relatable, observational humor, focusing on everyday themes rather than the raw, cutting edges of his own life.
The suit, the clean jokes.
Right. Pryor was initially a master of this, appearing impeccably dressed, delivering punchlines with a polished, almost sanitized precision that completely masked the tempest brewing within.
It's hard to even picture now.
This more conventional approach earned him regular spots on major TV variety shows, big ones. The Ed Sullivan Show, The Merv Griffin Show, The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
So he was getting noticed, playing the game.
Definitely. His burgeoning popularity even led to considerable success in the vibrant club scene of Las Vegas, the pinnacle of mainstream entertainment at the time.
Vegas was the goal for many back then.
Some of his earliest recordings, specifically the first five tracks on that 2005 compilation Evolution Revolution. The early years, 1966, 1974, they beautifully capture Pryor in this period, showcasing this more conventional style from 66, 67.
Right, before the big shift.
He even had a guest star appearance on the Western series The Wild Wild West in 1966, playing a character called Barman.
Ah, didn't know that one.
So you can see he was on a clear trajectory, right, to be a very successful but perhaps conventional comedian.
Fitting the mold.
He was fitting into the molds provided, gaining traction, popularity. But then, as often happens with truly groundbreaking artists, something seismic shifted.
Ah, here we go.
Here's where it gets really interesting, where the mask began to crack and the true Richard Pryor started to emerge. Third, breakthrough and transformation, finding his voice.
This moment, it's legendary. A radical, life-altering turning point.
Absolutely. Not just for his career, but for his whole artistic and personal identity. September 1967, performing at the Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas.
Vegas again, but different this time.
Totally different. Dean Martin is famously in the audience. Pryor stops mid-set, looks out at the sold-out crowd, pauses, and then with this electrifying force just yells into the microphone, "What the fuck am I doing here?" And then just walks off stage, leaves the audience stunned. It was this profound act of self-rejection, wasn't it?
Right.
Rejecting that Cosby-esque persona he'd been painstakingly cultivating.
A dramatic statement. He just couldn't do it anymore. It felt inauthentic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Afterward, this internal revolution quickly manifested externally. Pryor began incorporating profanity into his act with a vengeance.
Uh-huh. Including the big one.
Including, most controversially, the word nigger. His 1968 debut album, Richard Pryor, released on Dover Prize, is a vital recording. It captures this immediate evolution, reflecting the raw, unfiltered aftermath of this transformative moment.
You can hear the change.
And adding to his profound personal struggles during this transitional period, both his parents passed away in quick succession, his mother in 67, his father in 68.
Wow. All at the same time. Grief and artistic liberation colliding.
Must have deepened his already complex emotional landscape incredibly.
Yeah, this epiphany, it wasn't just a career move. It was profound, personal, and artistic liberation. It highlights how some artists must absolutely shatter expectations, even their own previously held ones, to truly find their authentic voice.
He had to break free.
Totally. The immediate, almost violent shift in his language on stage, particularly the raw and unfiltered use of the N-word, was incredibly provocative back then.
Hugely.
It was a sharp, intentional break from the more palatable, middle-of-the-road Cosby style he had imitated. Signaled a new, fearless, and often deeply uncomfortable approach to comedy that would define his legacy.
Shedding a skin.
Exactly. Revealing the raw nerves beneath. Embracing a style that allowed him to embody characters from his life, inhabit their voices, deliver social satire with an unprecedented cutting edge. Mm. It's the moment the observer became the participant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The storyteller became the story.
This transformation was further solidified when Pryor moved to Berkeley, California in 1969.
Oh, Berkeley. Perfect timing.
Right. Immersing himself in the vibrant counterculture scene flourishing there. In Berkeley, he engaged with influential figures like Huey P. Newton.
Wow, Black Panther founder.
Yep. And the renowned author Ishmael Reed. This environment undoubtedly fueled his evolving political and social perspectives, deepening his commentary and providing a platform for him to articulate the frustrations and aspirations of a generation seeking change.
Makes perfect sense. Berkeley in 69 was the place to be for that.
Throughout the 1970s, Pryor expanded his reach dramatically beyond stand-up stages. He became a highly sought-after writer for popular TV shows.
Right, using that voice in different ways.
Contributing his unique perspective to hits like Sanford and Son, The Flip Wilson Show, and even a 1973 Lily Tomlin special for which he shared a prestigious Emmy Award for Outstanding Writing.
An Emmy? People forget how successful he was as a writer, too.
Totally. His acting career also blossomed during this period, showcasing his versatility on the big screen. He appeared in critically acclaimed films like Lady Sings the Blues with Diana Ross, the blaxploitation classic, The Mac, Uptown Saturday Night, the buddy comedy Silver Streak.
With Gene Wilder, the start of that partnership.
Exactly. Car Wash, the gritty drama Blue Collar, and even made that memorable brief cameo in the Muppet movie as a balloon vendor.
Yeah, I remember that one.
As his presence grew on screen, the demand for Pryor's unique voice extended to his recording career. But that path, true to form, was also fraught with significant legal battles.
Always complications with Pryor.
It seems so. In 1970, Pryor signed with Laugh Records, that independent, comedy-oriented label. In 71, he recorded his second album, Craps, After Hours, still relatively early commercially for him.
Right, before the huge explosion.
Still relatively unknown to a mainstream national audience, he made a truly notable appearance in the 1972 documentary Wattstax.
Ah, yes, Wattstax was huge.
In this film, he powerfully riffed on the tragic comic absurdities of race relations in Watts and across the U.S., delivering a performance that really resonated.
You could see the power even then.
Not long after, seeking a larger platform, greater distribution, Pryor signed with Stax Records in 73. This led to the release of his true breakthrough album, That Nigger's Crazy, in 1974.
Landmark album. Absolutely changed the game.
But this success wasn't without complications. Laugh Records, claiming ownership from their earlier contract, almost succeeded in preventing the album's release with an injunction.
Ugh, legal battles.
A protracted legal battle ensued, eventually leading to Pryor's release from his Laugh contract. The compromise, however, was that Laugh was allowed to keep releasing older, unissued material he'd recorded between 68 and 73.
Ah, capitalizing on his new fame.
Exactly. They strategically timed these releases with his mainstream film successes. So albums like Are You Serious came out around Silver Streak, The Wizard of Comedy with The Wiz, Insane with Stir Crazy, created confusion among fans about what was current.
Yeah, that must have been frustrating for him. And confusing for listeners.
Despite these contractual complexities, That Nigger's Crazy was a commercial and critical sensation. Certified Gold won the Grammy for Best Comedy Album in 1975.
First Grammy. Huge deal.
When Stax Records briefly closed its doors, Pryor returned to reprise Warner Bros., his original label. They swiftly re-released That Nigger's Crazy and then followed up with Is This Something I Said in 75.
Another classic.
That one went platinum, earned him another Grammy in 76. The streak continued with Bicentennial Nigger in 76, his third consecutive gold album and Grammy winner in 77.
Three Grammys in a row for comedy. Unheard of.
Truly solidifying his status as an unparalleled comedic powerhouse and cultural force.
He was on top of the world, comedically speaking.
Beyond his groundbreaking stand-up, Pryor also made that significant, though controversial, mark as a writer in Hollywood. In 1974, co-writing Mel Brooks' satirical western Blazing Saddles.
Which is just iconic. Still hilarious.
Absolutely. Mm. What's particularly intriguing and a source of much debate is that Pryor was initially slated to play the lead role of Bart.
Right, the role Cleavon Little made famous.
Exactly. But conflicting accounts cloud the real reasons he didn't get the part. Mel Brooks later claimed Warner Brothers execs vetoed Pryor's casting, said he was uninsurable due to a drug arrest.
Hmm. But that's never been confirmed, has it?
No studio executive from that era has ever corroborated that specific claim. Leaves it open to interpretation.
Right.
Director Michael Schultz offered a different perspective. He stated, Richard wrote it and Mel Brooks chased him out, suggesting Brooks wanted total credit.
Ooh, that's a different angle entirely.
Pryor himself reportedly learned from Cleavon Little that he wouldn't be in the film. Must have been a painful blow, given his creative investment.
Well, for sure, especially after co-writing it.
This incident highlights not just the creative process, but also the power dynamics and, let's face it, racial politics at play in Hollywood back then.
Yeah, this Blazing Saddles incident, it raises important questions, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. About creative control, the subtle and overt racial politics in Hollywood, and how history gets retold often to serve particular narratives.
Absolutely.
It suggests a potential pattern, maybe, of Pryor's immense talent being recognized. I mean, he was clearly instrumental in shaping that iconic script, but his actual presence on screen, particularly in a leading role that would challenge racial norms like Bart certainly did.
Seen as too risky.
Exactly. Viewed as a significant risk by the studios, especially during a period when he was becoming increasingly outspoken and controversial in his stand-up, a risk they seemed unwilling to take, regardless of his undeniable writing contribution. Makes you wonder how many other groundbreaking projects might have been stifled by those anxieties.
He also explored mainstream television, but his provocative style often clashed head-on with network expectations, sometimes spectacularly so.
Yeah, SNL comes to mind.
1975 made history as the first black host of Saturday Night Live. His appearance included the now legendary and deeply controversial word association skit with Chevy Chase.
Still shocking to watch today. Push boundaries hard.
Totally. Forced audiences to confront uncomfortable truths on live TV. His longtime girlfriend at the time, Catherine McKee, even made a brief guest appearance with him on SNL, blurring the lines between personal and public.
Interesting.
2 years later, 1977, he gets his own variety show, The Richard Pryor Show, on NBC.
Huge opportunity.
Huge. But despite the platform, canceled after only 4 episodes.
4? That's it.
Yep. Swift cancellation, largely due to the show's controversial subject matter and Pryor's absolute unwillingness to alter his material for network censors. They just weren't ready.
What kind of stuff was he doing?
He portrayed the first black president decades before it happened, spoofed the Star Wars cantina, included a serious non-comedy skit on gun violence, surprisingly prescient, lampooned racism on the sinking Titanic, and even used clever costuming to appear visually nude on network TV.
Wow. He wasn't holding back.
Not at all. He famously said about the show, they offered me 10 episodes, but I said all I wanted 2 and 4.
Huh. Classic Pryor.
Yeah.
Commitment to his art over network demands.
Tells you everything. But another truly significant shift occurred in his personal and artistic life. A pivotal moment of introspection.
The trip to Africa.
Exactly. In 1979, at the absolute height of his success, Richard Pryor visited Kenya. Upon returning, he made a profound and very public declaration. He swore he would never use the word nigger in his stand-up routine again.
Which was huge, considering how central it had become to his commentary.
Right, how he'd famously reclaimed it from a slur into this complex comedic tool, a striking decision.
Yeah, this self-imposed ban on the N-word after his Africa trip is a truly pivotal moment, artistically and personally. It signifies a profound shift in his understanding of racial language and his responsibility as an influential voice.
What do you think he gained from that trip, experiencing a black majority society?
That's likely a huge part of it. Perhaps experiencing a different reality of black identity, one not constantly defined by the white gaze or the historical trauma of slavery, gave him a new perspective on the power and potential harm of that word.
A different weight to it.
Right. He spoke about feeling a different kind of burden responsibility after that experience, choosing to lead by example even when it meant reevaluating one of his most potent, albeit controversial, comedic tools. It showcased his remarkable capacity for introspection and growth, even at the peak of his fame. 4. Established career, stardom, struggles, and shifting artistic choices.
So the 1980s kick off with both unprecedented professional success and this nearly fatal personal crisis for Pryor, a dramatic illustration of the dualities that defined his life.
The highs and lows are extreme.
Absolutely. In 1980, he achieves this groundbreaking milestone. First black actor to earn $1 million for a single film. For Stuck Crazy.
$1 million in 1980. That was huge. Barrier breaking.
Not just a personal triumph, but a massive moment for black actors in Hollywood. However, this triumph was quickly overshadowed by that harrowing incident on June 9th, 1980.
The fire.
Yeah. While on a freebasing binge, that highly volatile method of smoking cocaine.
Right. Very dangerous process.
Pryor doused himself in rum and set himself on fire.
Rum.
Now, there are conflicting accounts. Some, including Pryor, said he poured rum on himself in a moment of drug-induced psychosis.
Mm.
Others, like the LAPD, described it as an explosion while he was freebasing. Either way,
the result was horrific.
Severe consequences. He ran screaming down Parthenia Street from his LA home, was subdued by police, treated for second and third degree burns covering more than half his body at the Grossman Burn Center.
Just unimaginable pain.
His daughter, Rain Pryor, later said it was drug-induced psychosis. His widow, Jennifer Lee, who had moved out after watching his addiction spiral, recalled the drug had become his lover, that she did not exist in its presence. Devastated.
Shows the depth of the addiction.
Remarkably, and this is just pure Pryor, he famously incorporated a description of this trauma into his show, Richard Pryor, live on the Sunset Strip in 82.
Turned it into comedy. How?
With his characteristic gallows humor, that dark, ironic approach, he joked the event was caused by dunking a cookie into low-fat milk, causing an explosion. At the end of the bit, he even poked fun at people telling jokes about him by waving a lit match and saying, "What's that? Richard Pryor running down the street."
Playing with fire, literally and figuratively, transforming near-fatal experience into uncomfortable, cathartic laughter.
That's Pryor.
Drawing these threads together, this incident is such a stark illustration of his unwavering commitment to mining his own pain for his art. It's a classic, albeit extreme, example of gallows humor, right?
Textbook.
Where he takes a deeply personal tragedy and, through the sheer force of his comedic genius, transforms it into a collective catharsis for his audience. This highlights the severe and very public struggles he faced with substance abuse, showcasing how deeply entwined his personal demons were with his creative process.
They fueled each other, maybe?
It seems that way. This wasn't just storytelling. It was a form of self-exorcism, performed live on stage, forcing both himself and his audience to confront the darkest corners of his experience. It's a powerful example of an artist not just surviving, but actively transmuting immense suffering into something profoundly impactful.
The freebasing incident had immediate, significant professional repercussions, too. Forced him to step back from projects at a critical time.
Right. Momentum interrupted.
He was replaced by Gregory Hines in Mel Brooks's History of the World, Part 1, a role Brooks had written specifically for him.
Ouch.
Similarly, a scheduled appearance on The Muppet Show around that time, which could have broadened his audience, had to be filled by the show's British writer, Chris Langham. Pryor was just unable to perform.
Understandable, given the circumstances.
Despite the profound trauma, the impact on his health and career, Pryor didn't stay away from stand-up for long. Incredible resilience.
He bounced back.
Within a year of the incident, he filmed and released a new concert film and album, Richard Pryor, here and now in 83, which he notably directed himself.
Taking control again.
Later, in 86, he took his experiences to the big screen, writing and directing Joe Dancer, Your Life is Calling, a fictionalized account of his life,
right,
directly inspired by the 80 incident.
Right, that autobiographical film?
Wasn't a major commercial success, but another deeply personal artistic endeavor, processing his trauma through performance.
Using art to heal, maybe.
The mid-80s saw Pryor attempting to navigate Hollywood with a major studio deal, a move some critics and fans felt steered him away from his raw roots towards more commercial fare.
The Columbia deal.
Yep. In 83, he signed a massive 5-year contract with Columbia Pictures for an astonishing $40 million. Unheard of for a black actor then.
$40 million, wow.
As part of the deal, he started his own production company, Indigo Productions, promising to open opportunities for minorities in the industry, still committed to representation.
Good for him. But the films changed.
This period was characterized by what had been described as softer, more formulaic films. Big budget projects like Superman the Third, for which he got $4 million.
Superman the Third, yeah, that was something.
Brewster's Millions, Moving, See No Evil, Hear No Evil, often starring alongside Gene Wilder.
More mainstream comedies.
Mm. Was it purely artistic choice or a pragmatic move in a tough industry, especially for him navigating past controversies and a huge studio deal? It's complex. Highlights that tension between creative integrity and commercial viability.
Always a balancing act in Hollywood.
Interestingly, he was originally considered for Billy Ray Valentine in Trading Places back in 83, the part Eddie Murphy eventually took.
Ah, another what if, Pryor and Murphy in that.
Wow. In a move that might have seemed completely out of character, he even ventured into children's television.
Really?
In 84, briefly hosted a show on CBS called Pryor's Place, similar to Sesame Street, where he'd also appeared earlier. Featured puppets, dealt with more sobering issues.
Huh. How'd it go?
canceled shortly after its debut. Maybe too subtle, or just too far from his established image.
Probably. Hard to square that with his stand-up persona.
He also took on the high-profile, challenging role of co-hosting the Academy Awards. Twice. First in 77, again in 83.
At the Oscars. That must have made the censors nervous.
Oh, definitely. Given his reputation for profanity, network censors issued stern warnings. After an early slip in one appearance, a 5-second delay was instituted when returning from breaks.
A delay just for him.
Made him one of only 3 SNL hosts, along with Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay, subjected to that. The networks were clearly both enamored and terrified of his unpredictable genius.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Which naturally leads us to ask an important question about the challenges of working with Pryor during this period, especially as his personal struggles intensify.
Yeah, his reputation.
He developed a reputation on film sets for being quite demanding, disrespectful, frequently late, making selfish and difficult requests. Gene Wilder provided a firsthand account in his autobiography detailing Pryor's behavior during Stir Crazy.
What did he say?
Wilder recounted Pryor demanding a helicopter to fly him to and from set, asserting his star status, maybe acting out.
Wow, the diva behavior.
Wilder also described an infamous incident he called the watermelon incident. Last week of filming, lunch break, crew member jokingly tosses watermelon, lands at Pryor's feet.
Oh boy.
Pryor immediately got up, went home, announced he was quitting show business, wouldn't return.
Just like that.
Days later, he returned all smiles after the camera operator who threw the watermelon was fired. Wilder, looking back, assumed Pryor was using drugs during filming, connecting the substance abuse to his erratic, demanding, sometimes paranoid behavior.
Paints a complex picture.
Definitely. A man wrestling with internal demons that profoundly impacted his professional relationships.
So, drawing these threads together, what's the core takeaway here? It highlights the immense pressure, the deep personal struggles he was grappling with, and how that manifested directly in his professional life.
Right. The lines blurred completely.
Paints a picture of an artist incredibly gifted, visionary, but also deeply troubled by his own demons and the immense toll of his life experiences. This tumultuous internal world often spilled over into his external conduct.
Which makes his groundbreaking work even more remarkable.
He delivered his genius despite, and perhaps because of, these profound internal conflicts, leaving those around him to navigate the often turbulent wake of his brilliant but volatile personality.
Well put.
Nearing the end of the decade, 1989, he starred in Harlem Nights.
Ah, with Eddie Murphy and Red Fox.
Exactly. Notable for bringing together 3 generations of Black comedians. Pryor, the ascendant Murphy, and the legendary Fox in this comedy-drama crime film.
Must have been quite a scene on set.
Can you imagine? The green room conversations, the stories, the sheer comedic power in one room. It was a significant collaboration. An elder statesman sharing the screen with a new wave he had undoubtedly influenced.
A direct lineage of comedic genius right there.
Hey!
Later years, an enduring legacy.
His later years were profoundly marked by that debilitating battle with multiple sclerosis. I mark it chronic, unpredictable disease affecting the central nervous system.
Diagnosed in 86, right?
Yes. By the mid-90s, the disease had progressed so much he largely relied on a power-operated mobility scooter, famously joking with characteristic dark humor that MS stood for more shit.
Still finding the humor, even then. Amazing.
Even in the face of such a devastating illness, his wit remained sharp, his spirit unbroken.
Mm-hmm.
His last film appearance was a small but poignant role in David Lynch's surreal mystery Lost Highway in 97, appeared on his scooter as Arnie, an auto repair garage manager, bringing his unique presence even to unconventional projects.
Even Lynch wanted him. Says a lot.
In 2000, Rhino Records released that comprehensive box set and its Deep 2, the complete Warner Bros. Recordings, mm-hmm. 1968 and 1992, remastering all his Reprise and Warner Bros. Albums, testament to his enduring discography.
Preserving the legacy.
His last television appearance was December 99 in the cold open of an episode of The Norm Show, playing Mr. Johnson, an elderly man in a wheelchair, again incorporating his physical reality into his acting.
Never shied away from it.
In 2002, a significant legal victory. Pryor and his wife, Jennifer Lee Pryor, won legal rights to almost 40 hours of unreleased material from his earlier Laugh Records days.
Getting that early stuff back.
led to the 2005 release of Evolution Revolution, The Early Years, 1966-1974, finally allowing fans to hear more of his early formative work, including the Middlebrow phase and the beginnings of his transformation.
Important context.
In late 2004, his sister claimed he had lost his voice due to MS-GAG, a heartbreaking possibility.
Right, that rumor went around.
But his wife, Jennifer Lee, directly refuted this on his official website in January 2005, quoting Pryor himself with his signature defiance, "I'm sick of hearing this shit about me not talking. Not true. I have good days, bad days, but I still am a talking motherfucker."
Still Cryer right to the end. Fierce.
On the morning of December 10th, 2005, just 9 days after his 65th birthday, Richard Pryor passed away.
So young, really.
Suffered his third and final heart attack at his L.A. home. His wife Jennifer's attempts to resuscitate him were tragically unsuccessful. Pronounced dead at 7:58 a.m. PST.
Sad end.
Jennifer Lee was later quoted as saying, with poignant simplicity, "At the end, there was a smile on his face. His body was cremated, ashes given to family, later scattered in Hana, Hawaii in 2019.
Wow.
Forensic pathologist Michael Hunter attributes his fatal heart attack to severe coronary artery disease, at least partially brought on by years of heavy tobacco smoking, a somber reminder of the toll his lifestyle took.
Yeah, the body keeps the score, doesn't it? To truly understand Pryor's unique genius, though, it's also incredibly important to look at who he admired. Who he drew inspiration from reveals the breadth of his artistic absorption.
Good point. Who was on his list?
His influences were remarkably wide-ranging, showcasing a deep appreciation for the craft across many styles. Physical comedians like Chaplin, Jackie Gleason, Red Skelton, Abbott and Costello.
The classics.
Comedic actors like Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin, Jack Benny, Bob Hope. Intellectual and observational comics like Woody Allen, Dick Gregory, Lenny Bruce.
Boundary pushers.
And of course, fellow pioneers of black comedy like Bill Cosby, whom he initially drew inspiration from before his radical departure, and the legendary Red Fox.
That's quite a diverse group.
This extensive list shows a remarkable breadth, right? From slapstick to observational traditional entertainment to boundary pushing social commentary. It highlights how he didn't just imitate, but deeply synthesize various styles and approaches.
Filtered through his own life.
Exactly. Filtering them through his own tumultuous life experience to forge a voice that was utterly unique. It wasn't about simply copying. It was absorbing these diverse elements and then, through the crucible of his own lived chaos, creating something entirely new.
Exploding the forms.
Totally. Infusing them with a rawness and truth that was unprecedented. Truly elevating comedy to an art form capable of profound social commentary.
His death, far from diminishing his impact, really solidified his place as an unparalleled master, a giant.
Absolutely. The acclaim from his peers says it all.
Jerry Seinfeld, meticulous craftsman, called Pryor the Picasso of our profession.
Picasso, high praise.
Bob Newhart, deadpan master, heralded him as the seminal comedian of the last 50 years. Dave Chappelle, profoundly influenced by Pryor's fearlessness.
Chappelle owes a lot to him.
Declared, and I quote, "You know those, like, evolution charts of man? He was the dude walking upright. Richard was the highest evolution of comedy."
Wow, that paints a picture. Pushing the boundaries of what comedy could be.
And Bill Cosby, from whom Pryor initially drew inspiration before his break, famously observed, "Richard Pryor drew the line between comedy and tragedy as thin as one could possibly paint it."
Perfectly capturing that unique blend of tears and laughter.
His groundbreaking contributions were recognized with numerous awards and honors, life and posthumously. In 98, he received the very first Kennedy Center Mark Twain Prize for American Humor.
The first one ever. Fitting.
Fitting tribute to a man who, like Twain, used wit to expose uncomfortable truths. He was slandered, as the Kennedy Center president said, because he struck a chord and a nerve with America, forcing it to look at large social questions of race and the more tragicomic aspects of the human condition.
Nailed it.
In 2004, Comedy Central voted him number one on their definitive list of the 100 greatest stand-ups of all time.
Number one? Ahead of everyone.
Posthumously, awarded the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2006. Recognition of his monumental recording legacy. Also received the NAACP Image Award Hall of Fame in 96, Outstanding Actor NAACP Award in 81, and shared that Writers Guild Award for Blazing Saddles in 74.
The accolades just kept coming. Rightfully so.
Beyond his artistic achievements, Pryor also had this deep humanitarian side, particularly concerning animal welfare.
Oh, right. The PETA connection.
Received a PETA Humanitarian Award in 99, and the organization now gives out an award in his name. He actively campaigned for animal welfare, concerned about elephants in circuses and zoos, was also a vegetarian.
Didn't know he was vegetarian. Interesting facet.
His hometown of Peoria honored him with that magnificent life-size bronze statue, Richard Pryor, more than just a comedian. Created by artist Preston Jackson, placed downtown in 2015 near his childhood neighborhood.
Keeping his memory alive right where it started.
Ensuring his physical presence is remembered in the place that shaped him. Most recently, inducted into the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York in 2022, cementing his place in the pantheon.
Where he belongs.
Decades after his breakthrough, documentaries and biopics continue to explore his rich, complex life, testament to the enduring fascination.
People are still trying to figure him out.
Numerous documentaries. The Funny Life of Richard Pryor, Richard Pryor. I Ain't Dead Yet, #%, hashtag it a day. The Funniest Man Dead or Alive, Richard Pryor. Omit the Logic, I Am Richard Pryor, each offering different perspectives.
So much material to cover.
His film work celebrated in retrospectives like a Pryor engagement at BAM Cinemas in 2013, allowing new generations to appreciate his cinematic impact.
Right. Introduce him to new audiences.
The efforts to create a definitive biopic, Richard Pryor, or is it something you say, have been ongoing for years. Challenging endeavor, given the complexities.
I bet. Who do you get to play Pryor? Tough casting.
Yeah. Various actors, Marlon Wayans, Mike Epps, Eddie Murphy, and directors like Bill Condon, Lee Daniels, have been attached. Oprah's been a producer. Mike Epps, currently attached to Star, shows the enduring power and challenge of bringing his incredible story to the screen.
Hopefully they get it right someday. It's a story that needs telling.
Yeah.
Sixon. Personal life. A complex tapestry.
His personal life was, in many ways, as tumultuous and unpredictable as his stage persona, marked by a series of intense relationships and marriages, often intertwined with his public struggles.
Yeah, rarely simple with Pryor.
He dated actress Pam Grier, met her through Freddie Prinze, cast together in Grease Lightning in 77. Grier tried to help him with his drug addiction, but in a complicated turn, Pryor ended up marrying another woman while still dating Grier.
Oof, Bessie.
He also dated actress Margot Kidder during the filming of Some Kind of Hero in 82. Kidder famously said she fell in love with Pryor in 2 seconds flat upon meeting him, described a powerful, immediate connection.
He clearly had charisma, intense magnetism.
Which brings us to a rather astonishing statistic. Pryor was married 7 times to 5 different women.
7 times, wow. Okay, let's listen.
Patricia Price, 1960-61, Shelley Bonus, 1967-69, Deborah Maguire, 1977-78, Jennifer Lee, initially 81-82, then remarried 2001 until his death in 2005. Though validity contested, she still controls his estate.
Right. Jennifer Lee, the constant later on.
And Flynn Boleyn, initially 86-87, then remarried 90-91. This dizzying array of marriages speaks volumes, doesn't it? About his passionate nature, his search for stability, perhaps the difficulty of maintaining conventional relationships amidst his extraordinary life and personal struggles.
All the above, probably. Chaos seemed to follow him, or he created it.
He also had a large family, fathering 7 children with 6 different women, reflecting the complex, often chaotic nature of his personal world.
7 kids, too. Big family.
Renee Pryor, born 57, with girlfriend Susan. Richard Pryor Jr., born 62, with first wife Patricia Price. Elizabeth Ann, born 67, with girlfriend Maxine Anderson. Rain Pryor, born 69, with second wife Shelley Bonus.
Rain is quite well known herself.
Stephen, born 84, with Flynn Boleyn, who later became wife, #5. Franklin, born 87, with girlfriend Geraldine Mason. And Kelsey, born 87, also with 5th wife, Flynn Boleyn.
Wow. Complicated family tree. Underscores the unconventional paths of his life, but also his legacy as a father, a role often unmentioned amidst his public persona, which naturally leads us to a fascinating and for some controversial aspect of his personal identity.
Yeah.
His sexuality. This raises an important question about the fluidity of identity and public perception, especially given the various accounts and the times he lived in.
Right. This came up more recently.
9 years after his death in 2014, that biography, Becoming Richard Pryor by Scott Saul, stated Pryor acknowledged his bisexuality. Then, in 2018, both music legend Quincy Jones and Pryor's widow, Jennifer Lee, made headlines.
The Quincy Jones interview, that was wild.
Stating he had a sexual relationship with iconic actor Marlon Brando and was open with friends about his bisexuality and sleeping with men.
Caused quite a stir.
Pryor's daughter, Rain, later disputed these claims, leading Jennifer Lee to state Rain was in denial. Lee also notoriously commented on TMZ, "It was the 70s. Drugs were still good. If you did enough cocaine, you'd fuck a radiator and send it flowers in the morning."
Yikes. A cynical but maybe era reflective take highlights the hedonism and blurred lines back then.
perhaps.
Yeah.
These differing accounts underscore the challenge of piecing together a comprehensive narrative of such a private yet publicly exposed life.
What's truly fascinating here, though, beyond the differing accounts from others, is how multiple narratives contribute to our understanding, and how Pryor himself was remarkably candid, even provocative, about his experiences long before these discussions were common or acceptable.
He talked about it himself.
Oh, yeah. In his autobiography, Pryor Convictions, he discussed a two-week relationship with a trans woman named Matrasha, referring to it openly as 2 weeks of being gay.
Wow, okay.
In his first special, Live and Smokin', he openly discussed experimenting with homosexuality. He was even more explicit at a 1977 gay rights show at the Hollywood Bowl.
What did he say there?
He stated, "I have sucked a dick." Clarifying, the incident happened in 1952, when he was 11 or 12, with someone named Wilbur Harp, and admitted to engaging in anal sex with Harp.
Whoa. That level of raw, uncensored self-revelation delivered publicly in the 70s.
Truly ahead of its time. Demonstrated a radical honesty about his own experiences, regardless of societal judgment.
Incredible candor. His body also bore the heavy toll of his lifestyle and illnesses, which undoubtedly contributed to his later struggles.
Yeah, the health issues piled up.
He suffered a mild heart attack at age 36 in November 77. Stark reminder of the long-term consequences of years of heavy smoking and drinking.
36 is so young for a heart attack.
Experienced a second heart attack in Australia in 1990. Subsequently underwent triple heart bypass surgery in 1991. Intense medical procedure.
Right.
The third and final heart attack, as we discussed, was in 2005, and most significantly, diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, MS in 86, progressively led to severe mobility issues, forcing him onto the scooter by the mid-90s.
And the claims about losing his voice near the end
were, as we heard, famously refuted by Pryor himself through his wife. Underscoring his fierce determination to maintain his voice, his essence, these numerous health battles highlight the immense physical and mental challenges he faced throughout his career and later life, often performed and processed right there in the public eye.
Yeah, open book, even in suffering.
Outro. So drawing all these incredible, often contradictory threads together, what's the core takeaway from our deep dive into the life of Richard Pryor? We've journeyed through the incredible highs and profound lows of his existence.
Quite the journey.
From a childhood marked by abuse and instability, growing up in a brothel, suffering deep trauma, to becoming this unparalleled comedic voice who fearlessly tackled race, class, sexuality, personal demons.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen how his raw honesty, born from these intensely personal struggles, even harrowing incidents like the freebasing fire, fundamentally transformed comedy, consistently challenged audiences, even as his own life was often a battlefield of addiction, health crises, complex relationships.
A figure of immense contradictions. Absolutely. But those very contradictions were the fertile wellspring of his genius, weren't they?
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Pryor's journey is such a powerful reminder that genius often emerges from unexpected, even deeply painful places. His unparalleled ability to distill his most vulnerable, controversial, even traumatic experiences into humor that resonated so deeply with millions. It speaks to a unique kind of bravery.
Definitely.
And a profound understanding of the human condition. His legacy isn't just about the countless laughs he provided. It's about the uncomfortable, unflinching mirrors he held up to society and to himself.
Forcing us to confront difficult truths.
Exactly. About racism, addiction, identity, the resilience of the human spirit. He didn't just redefine the boundaries of what comedy could achieve. He detonated them, leaving a landscape where honesty became the highest form of art.
Richard Pryor not only changed comedy, he fundamentally changed how we talk about race, class, sexuality, addiction, often by simply being fearlessly, uncomfortably, unapologetically himself.
That's the core of it.
His work invites us to consider what truly constitutes courage in an artist to bear one's soul with such intensity. And maybe, what price are we as a society willing to let them pay for the uncomfortable truths they reveal about ourselves and the world we inhabit?
Heavy question.
It is. It's a question that, like Pryor's legacy, continues to echo profoundly, challenging us to look deeper and laugh harder, even when it hurts.
A legacy that endures, no doubt about it.